Our guest speaker is Professor Dowling. I looked him up on Wikipedia and tell him about himself. Says among other things, he's Halford McKinder Professor of Geography, the School of Geography, the Environment, the University of Oxford. He went to Cheney School, which I'm told, according to them, is a co-educational comprehensive. I'll read the rest of Dowling to talk about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to talk for about 25 minutes. Has anybody got questions?
Yeah, Cheney is now sadly an academy, just like every other secondary in the county. But one day it will return to the fold. Health and what the Conservatives have done and why they've got the worst record since 1891. This story has been slowly unfolding the last 4 or 5 years. And the most recent part of this story happened about a week ago when the British Medical Journal, its BMJ Open publication, published a paper by 10 authors, I wasn't one of them, directly linking the policies of the government since 2010, so the Coalition and then the Conservatives, to 120,000 premature deaths. Can't absolutely prove it, but in that study they did the best thing you could to show it's very unlikely to be anything else. What I'm going to do is take you through the history of this for a little bit and then about the current last 5, 6, 7 years, because it's the history which makes it really stand out. Because this hasn't happened for a very long time before. The other thing that matters politically is that this affects people everywhere. It's not just Oxford East and Oxfordshire. In fact, most of it is actually Oxfordshire. It's taken me some time to realise, coming back to this county, that there is one thing that people in the county really value about the city. And of course, it's not the universities, and it's not the city council, they don't like them. It's the John Radcliffe. Because people in the county absolutely rely on John Radcliffe for their help. And once you begin to realise what's happening to health in Britain, then it is quite frightening. But we go right back. 1841 is when the first life tables were produced. Because many infants died, you had women living to 42 and men to 40. Nerdiness, life expectancy, is the arithmetic average number of years you can expect to live if you were a newborn baby to die, and if the current mortality rates today that pertain to men and women of every age were to pertain to you, that's what you could expect. That's what the life expectancy is. It's not particularly easy average, but that's it. 42 and 40 in 1841. By 1891, it had crept up to 48 and 44. We still hadn't accepted germ theory by then. We still weren't getting sanitation completely right, although we were bringing in sewers and so on. But from then onwards, from about 1891, things begin to pick up. So you can see that those little lines beginning to head upwards quite fast, whereas before it had been quite slow. In Victorian times, we had some of the worst conditions in the world. In Liverpool, Manchester, we managed to get life expectancy to the high 20s. Which you very rarely get anywhere. But by 1891, we were beginning to see solid improvements. By 1901, you're looking at 52 years for women and 48 for men. And it didn't make any difference at this point whether you had a Tory or a Liberal, or even later, Labour governments. Fairly nasty Tory governments saw increases of a high rate. You could argue because of agitators before, but there isn't a pattern in general of Tories doing worse than Liberals at this point before we get Labour. By 1921, women are living till 60 on average and men to 56, and the gains are becoming incredible. These are 8 years of life expectancy for both men and women gained in just 20 years. That's the kind of speed you're looking at. By 1951, women are on 72 and men on 66. Women are gaining 12 years, men are only gaining 10, because after the First World War, during the First World War, a very large number of men started to smoke. Better maternity care helps. The NHS helped even before it actually came into existence in 1948. Health improved because people knew it was coming, particularly old people. And this really matters about old people. And these improvements carried on in the early 50s and the late 40s, despite austerity, despite rationing. And the reason I'm going to go on about the history is just to try to point out how incredible what's happened most recently has been. There was a slowdown in the 50s. Now, part of that slowdown was that, if you like, the easy wins had been done. But it was also a little bit political. When we had that great smog in London, Harold Macmillan decided to blame it on influenza. And they managed to get away with blaming it on influenza for about 4 years before we finally got a Clean Air Act, and it clearly wasn't influenza, we now know. And the reason for pointing that out is that the most recent rises in mortality were again initially blamed on influenza. And this is an old trick. There is a worry at the moment. We've had 5, 6, 7 years of relatively low rates of flu. Currently in Australia and New Zealand, the number of cases of flu has doubled in their winter, our summer. So we might actually be getting a bad flu coming this winter. And if you put that on top of everything else, that would be an incredible crisis to get. By 1971, life expectancy of women is at 75 and men's at 69. So it's just rattling. Okay, the gradient's no longer as steep as it was before, but you're still going up at a fairly high rate. The improvements coming on through the 1970s. The 1970s is the most maligned decade in the last 100 years. The 1970s was absolutely brilliant for social progress. The 1970s is the only decade in which the population centre of the country actually moved north for a few years. In the 1970s, Sheffield had a higher life expectancy than the national average. So I just get annoyed about people going on about the 1970s and saying it was bad. The 1970s was good. In contrast, as you well know, the 80s were terrible. But even with the terrible 1980s and the terrible cuts to health spending, I mean, John Radcliffe up there only had 8 intensive therapy unit beds by the end of the 1980s. This is serving a population of well over 1 million. And if the 8th bed was full and you were hit by a car, that's kind of like bad luck. Even despite that, by 1991, women were living on average 79 and men to 73, gaining 4 years in 20 years. So not as fast as improvement at the highest, but still pretty fast. We're getting up to date here. Next 20 years, men catch up a little, because more of them have smoked initially, so it's easier for them to be ex-smokers, and that always helps. By 2011, women were expected to live to 83 and men to 79. So in those last 20 years, women had gained 3 years and men had gained 5, mainly because of the smoking thing. 6-year gap had gone back to 4 years. Rate of improvement, no slowdown whatsoever. We can talk later about, you know, eventually there has to be a slowdown. People aren't going to be immortal. But so far, no slowdown. And then, since 2011, under Theresa May and David Cameron, it's flatlined. The graph, it looks like it's going up slightly because it's actually from about 2010, but it really has gone flat. European statistics have no increase in life expectancy in the UK from 2011 to 2015. Everywhere else in Europe has had an increase. Norway and Finland, it's an increase of a year in that time. We've had none. The latest figures were published by the ONS in September, and they gave women a life expectancy of 83.06 years, men 79.4. It's basically the same as it was 5 years earlier. There are areas of the country, Blackburn, Blackpool, life expectancy going down, some others are going up, it's static. And that doesn't happen. Stopped improving. Life expectancy is the most basic measure by which you judge a government. It's the hardest one to fiddle. You know, your GDP can go up if you have a war, because Well, you're more productive making things for that. But life expectancy is the basic way in which we measure how governments do. So this is quite shocking. Now, just as some villain had done, the government or its agencies initially tried to blame the flu for the deaths. But as the years went by, life expectancy carried on not rising, you can't try to make out its flu every winter, particularly when you don't have enough cases of flu to make out its flu. And also, flu epidemics tend to happen in about 5, 6, 7 weeks, not over months and months of accelerated deaths that we saw. The most plausible explanation, and the problem is that we don't have a randomised trial. We didn't inflict Jeremy Hunt on some counties and not Jeremy Hunt on others. There are ways. Anyway, we didn't do that. But the most plausible explanation is austerity. Particularly high effects on poor and elderly people. Elderly more than poor to begin with, then poor. Early on, by 2003, you had to withdraw care support for 500,000 elderly people. That's things like not getting visits. These visits are often said to be, what's the use of somebody turning up, taking their coat off, putting the kettle on, making a tea, and leaving 50 minutes later? If you've just fallen down to the bottom of the stairs 2 days ago, that visit is useful. This is also useful for realising that something's wrong. There are actually 1 million fewer of those per year from about 2013 onwards. We've got cuts in real terms to NHS budgets, given the increase in the population of elderly and needy. Whenever the government say they're spending a bit more, they're not spending a bit more per head of person who needs it. You only have to go to the up the hill to John Radcliffe on Monday morning, round about, and at 8 you watch the relatives beginning after they've tried to keep their loved ones alive all weekend. That's when they bring them in. And the queue goes all the way back, 8 o'clock every morning. It's just a denial of funding. Then the 2012 Health and Social Care Act, which caused disruption and was an attempt to increase privatisation of the system. Increased rates of bankruptcy and general decline in old age people's care homes. Do you remember, I think it was Southern Cross? Yeah. Just the fear. You don't have to go bankrupt. Just feeling insecure. And there have been, ironically, randomised control trials of this. Even ones which involve putting pot plants in some old people's rooms in care homes and not in others. And you can actually see this has an effect on your length of life. So if having a pot plant affects your life, thinking that you're about to be evicted and got nowhere to live is likely to have a somewhat larger effect. I'm shocked that nobody ever says where the main source of Philip Hammond's £9 million is, which is care homes. And he makes the £9 million wealth he's got by making sure he's not paying the people who work in the care homes enough so that he doesn't get that kind of a profit. That's the kind of thing. Rising fuel poverty, cuts and removals to disability benefits, cuts to pension and credits came in. All of this, the coincidence of it, it just fits too well. There may be other things going on. There may be an opposite to the 1948 NHS effect, where before the NHS came in, health improved because people felt so optimistic and the war had ended, and psychologically that helped. Suicides should surely go down in wartime, go back after war, but they suicides, particularly amongst the elderly, fell a couple of years before the NHS and pensions came in, because you weren't going to be a burden on young people. Now, I have a slight worry that, you know, some of the reason for this is people who are elderly thinking, where's the world going, what's happening, maybe harder to struggle on. But there are lots of things to investigate, but you come down to the basic causes. The other kind of thing we're worried to investigate is, would healthcare professionals or families help keep somebody alive in 2016 in the same circumstances that they might in 2007? And if you've got somebody who's very ill and you're worried about whether you resuscitate or not, if you're in an underfunded health service where you need more beds, would you make the same decision as we made when things were getting better? There is a complexity to all this. But at the end of the day, underlying it all is a callousness and a not caring about the money. Sorry, that's more words, which will end soon. But I wanted to give you the background and then get up to this. The very first we affected, and this became clear in 2012 and 13, it was 5 weeks stopping life expectancy, first of all, was elderly women, 85-year-old women, who were mostly living on their own, and that's the difference between elderly women and elderly men, in the poorest parts of the UK. And then the areas that have been targeted by the Labour government for interventions, where those interventions stopped. There were experts writing in the British Medical Journal calling for an inquiry, but the government refused. Government officials claimed that the recent high death rates in older people were not exceptional. So it isn't that government officials won't say anything. They will say things like that, but then they go quiet. They've gone more quiet more recently. There's a particular press officer in his 20s at the Department of Health whose job it seems to be to rebut any suggestion that life isn't completely rosy. And I know that if you're a press officer of the Department of Health, you know, in theory you're supposed to be loyal to your masters, but there comes a point when, you know, the worst health records since 1891, with some colleagues who've just put in a Freedom of Information request to ask for all their rebuttals, so we can put them all together and see what they look like. It's bad across the whole of the UK, particularly bad in Scotland. Not much gets said about that. None of the four chief medical officers has yet said a word about it, which again is interesting. Public Health England has, apart from saying early on they thought it might be flu, hasn't said much. Michael Marmot, who works for The Independent, and this really matters. Anybody paid directly by government doesn't say anything. People who are looking at independently do. Michael Marmot, who works at the Institute of Health Equity, has linked the cuts to rising deaths, particularly amongst people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And that's the group it's easiest to in effect, withdraw the care from. I wrote one paper of researchers in Liverpool, Glasgow, New York, where we found a connection between the rising mortality rates and delays in discharging of elderly patients. It was significant just on the test, but that's all that matters. The Financial Times was in a very sort of strange and sad way, has had various reports about this, because the Institute of Actuaries, these are the people who measure life expectancy for your health insurance or your pensions, they've worked out this is happening. And there was a series of stories. The stories, and the irony is, the stories were not actually shock horror, this is terrible. The stories were, oh, it looks like the pension industry is going to be okay. So that was the premise. And the last one, we think it may have overestimated it. But the last one claimed that what had happened to cut $310 billion from the liabilities of some of the best-off pension schemes. Pension schemes like mine, University Pension Scheme. This is everybody's pension. These are the better-off pensions, private pensions, if in effect, managed by the Institute of Actuaries. $310 billion. It is absolutely shocking. So that lets you work out how many years of life they think are not going to happen in the future that they thought were going to happen a little bit earlier. I made myself read out these lists when I do this. We have one of the lowest rates of good health for babies and children in Western Europe. Malta is slightly worse than us. Romania is worse. And it's Northern Ireland. Infant mortality has stopped improving. The only other rich country in the world where that's happened is the United States in recent years. Life expectancy for women in the UK is now lower than in Austria, Belgium, Cyprus, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Iceland, Ireland, Italy, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, Malta, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland. If you're trying to work out who's missing from that list, it's Denmark. The Danes used to smoke at an incredible rate, helping prove that no matter how lovely you are in other ways, cigarettes are still bad for you. But the young Danes have stopped, so Denmark is zooming up. Men do slightly better in the UK, only slightly, and again that's smoking, but they're still very, very bad. Almost every other affluent country in the world, people live longer than the UK. Most importantly, though, in these other countries, particularly the ones who are very good at being socially progressive, which is Japan, Norway and Finland, Japan is the most incredible country. I won't get into it, but women can live 8 years longer than men. It's not just the highest life expectancy in the world, and it's sexist in ways, but I'll leave Japan off. But I don't know what you do if you're working in Japan, Norway and Finland. There's not much you can do to say, how can we make things better? When you have these kind of improvements on already high base. It's pretty obvious in Britain what we should be doing. The kind of question is, why are we not doing it?
More meat, more sushi.
Yes. Now, very latest statistic, this is October 26th, 27th, the Office of National Statistics produced the latest life table. The latest life table is based on data that was collected up to 2016. In the seventh footnote of their press release, they said that in the future life expectancy would be almost a year lower for men and women in Britain. In the seventh footnote, this is the biggest thing that's happened. They and their predecessors, OPCS, have been collecting this data since the first registrar general, and it's in the seventh footnote. I think they're scared. I think they're afraid of what government might do to them when government realises that it's official statistics that show this away. So what we've got now, why this matters for people like me who've been going on about this for 4 or 5 years, is we no longer have to say we've worked out it's happening. The official projections from government now say, if you take one away from another, that by 2057 at least 1 million fewer years of life are going to be lived, given the worsening situation. That's a minimum of 1 million fewer. 4/5 of that 1 million years is people currently aged 14 to 60. So if people understood this, and I know I'm very nerdy, and it's all, you know, this isn't the kind of Jennifer Ears story, this is numbers. But if people understood it, most of what's happening, if it were to continue, will affect people aged 40 to 60. And those figures say that already around about almost 40,000 people have died in the year up to June this year. Of those people, 2,000 were men and 1,000 were women between 20 and 60. So currently mostly elderly people dying a bit earlier than you'd expect. But in future it'll be people who are younger dying earlier. Now the reason why ONS say that there will be more early deaths in future is migration, because they say there's going to be less migration for obvious reasons. It's not because we're going to have more births, because they say we're going to have fewer births, not least because so many of our midwives come from the EU, but not the UK, particularly up the hill. It's simply because of the rise in mortality. But it's not the job of ONS, although they don't feel it's their job to point out how exceptional it is. The little graph there, which is slowly getting bigger, is showing the relationship between life expectancy on the y-axis and inequality on the x-axis. And basically, countries which share the money better, people live longer. All the little dots are United States, states of the US. So it's Mississippi that's doing really bad on 75. You don't want to be in Mississippi, you don't want to be a baby born in Mississippi. Mississippi has rising infant mortality at quite a high rate now. Japan is high up there.
Sorry, what's the horizontal map?
It's a take of the best off 1%. Actually, way back in 1983. It's my favourite measure of inequality is how much the top 1% take. There are lots of different
ones. Income.
That's its income, annual income. if you can get the top 1% down, well, the best we ever did was taking about 6% of all income. That's 6 times average income. If you can get them down to that, you're doing really well as a country. The top 1% always have the most.
Yeah,
no definition. But the interesting thing is that the share of the top 1% appears to matter much more than any other measure of inequality. The dangerous thing of that is it tells you how you treat the very poor isn't crucial for the society as a whole. It's actually what you let the very richest get away with that's crucial for society as a whole. I don't want to shout that too loud because I don't want people to think. And if you look at the very poorest in Japan, they are abandoned. They're in blue tents. They're a very small group.
abandoned by their family, and the state will actually, in theory, look after you if your family abandons you. But Japan doesn't look after the very poor particularly well. It controls its riches incredibly well. Owen Jones has a statistic, which I don't believe could be true, but it's in his book, where he says that there are fewer people in Japan earning over €1 million equivalent a year than in the Barclays Bank Tower in Canary Wharf. We know, we've got lots of stats on Japan, it is incredibly equal. But by not having your elite so pulled away from the rest of society, you see it in, well, I think the best example of it was the tsunami. The reaction to the tsunami, which was instant reaction to help. I was there a month after it hit, and I was with the census officers, because that's what I do, and they were dismantling these huge hangars where they had all the census forms early. I said, what are you doing? They said, we're sending them up because they're needed, there's not enough shelter. And I said, that's great, when did you get the order? And they said, we didn't get any order. We decided ourselves, the civil servants, just to do this, because the people need it. And because they care about other people. And Japan wasn't always like this. It's not a natural thing. Japan was incredibly unequal in the 30s. It was one of the most unequal societies with aristocracy that didn't treat other people as human. And the irony of what happened to Japan is that the Americans, after the war, redistributed the land and wealth as much as was humanly possible because they were scared there would be a communist revolution. So the Americans made Japan the most equal country. So they created this kind of like it's called a 90% middle class, which is identical to a 90% working class, because you no longer have that instrumentation. And it's an incredible story. That we get the same figures in Scandinavia. It's just that Scandinavia is small and you sort of think, how can you replicate that? Norway has oil. Japan has no natural resources. But I mean, if you want to be less depressed about all this, somebody has to be one of the, we are the most unequal country, OECD country of Europe. Somebody has to be. And then the US is more than us. Winning wars isn't good for controlling your elite. They tend to take the credit for it, and they keep their estates and their castles. Not that you wouldn't want to win a war. Using a Brexit campaign, I always think, if you're going to have an economic disaster, when it comes to economic disasters, this one's bad, but it's not as bad as war or famine or disease, so it's possible. Anyway, I've got one more slide up. it might be Brexit, but go on.
Am I reading that correctly, that Germany is more unequal than we are?
Germany was in 1983. So the data's from 1983, and you've got to remember in 1983, Germany, and this is including Eastern Germany. So Germany isn't now. It's actually moved. I should have put out the more recent data. German 1% do take, I think, about 10 or 11% of all income in Germany, whereas here they're taking about 15%. So it's one of the stats Germany does bad on. Other statistics on income inequality, Germany's pretty good. It's not as good as France, but the second good large country in Europe. They just have this small group of entrepreneurs or industrialists in Germany who do rather well. But they're not like the billionaires that we have. They actually do run factories. Make cars that people want to buy around the world. For big countries, the US is the most unequal. You've got then us, then Spain, which I think is fascinating. You think of things called cock-ups. The biggest is the US, then ours is fairly big. Spain's is fairly minor. Then Italy, then Germany, then France. It's a kind of order. We have slightly higher income inequality in Israel. It's quite an achievement. Okay. Final slide. So the British Medical Journal, 15th of November, and when this came out, I just thought, well, that's it. This is going to do it. These were 10 mainly Dell medics, young medics, also came at UCL, had done big econometric analysis with the correlations in,
and said, as far as they could find out, it looked as if 120,000 of the excess deaths which has occurred, which is most of them, can be associated with the cuts. It's reported in The Sun and The Mail and The Express and The Mirror and Independent Online. It wasn't reported in The Guardian. And the reason was I emailed them is because the health correspondent was on holiday. Because I got the on holiday reply from the health correspondent. But not The Times, The Telegraph or the BBC. Simon Ben Lewis, who's an economist based in Oxford, this is one of his most recent blogs, and the most recent blog, in which he says it's one thing economists like him say the average family's already £4,000 a year worse off and so on. And the BBC will report that. Or say that it's just economists what they know. But reporting 120,000 early deaths as a result of the government, the BBC found an excuse not to do it. Partly because how on earth, I don't know the answer to this, but now I'll leave you this question. You can ask me questions, but I'll leave you a question. If you're the BBC and you're charged with being politically impartial, and you've got to place yourself between the Labour and the Conservative Party, and evidence begins to emerge, the Conservative Party, I think not deliberately, I have to say, I actually do not think this is deliberate. I think it's stupid and misguided. But if evidence emerges that this Conservative government, unlike any previous Conservative government, who were not nice in Victorian times, if evidence emerges that they are responsible through their actions for 120,000 premature deaths, how do you report that as a national broadcaster when you're supposed to be politically independent? So this is the point that we're at. More and more will begin to come out. You can't disguise these statistics. People only die once. It's not like cause of death, which can be, you know, you're not quite sure what it is. When this happens, it's pretty obvious it's happened. Smoking rates continue to go down. It's not that we've had a sudden, very fast glut of obesity or anything. It is happening amongst the most frail and elderly people the most. It is pretty clear what it is. Lawrence King, who is one of the 10 who contributed to the study, said it's now very clear that austerity doesn't promote growth, it doesn't reduce deficits, it's bad economics. But he went, it's good class politics. Maybe he shouldn't say this because it made it easy for the BBC to report. This study shows it's also a public health disaster. It's not an exaggeration to call it economic murder. Now, I wouldn't call it murder. I honestly don't think they planned for this to happen. It's fairly callous, very stupid. It's similar to Margaret Thatcher in 1984 signing up to the World Health Organization Target 1 for health, which was to halve the inequality between people by social class by year 2000. Well, I think Thatcher actually thought she would. She thought trickle down would happen. The poor would benefit more from her policies than the rich. By the year 2000, the gap had actually doubled, not halved. But at least Margaret Thatcher didn't want it to double. I don't think they want this to happen. Not least, if you want to be really ironic about it, who are the kind of people who make it to 84, 85, but not to 87 now? They're largely people who were middle class in the past. Working class people don't on average live that long. These are people who voted for Margaret Thatcher in 1979 and 83, disproportionately, who are now dying early. But, I mean, there's a small amount of justice, but not very much. So, anyway, you've let me talk for longer than I say, I've let me talk for half. Any questions before I let you get on with your business?
I'll
keep my answer short as well.
My first comment is really, you say Conservative government, it's not a rational decision on their part. It's just part of their attempt to sort of reduce the state, I suppose, you can probably argue. But all the things that they have done politically, like splitting apart part responsibility for the health service. So you now get the Secretary of State and you get Stephen, whatever his name is. I mean, that's really diverting attention from, you know, it's possible the government said, you know, it's his fault and not the Secretary of State's fault for what's happening to the NHS. The thing that they've done in terms of the hospital service, in terms of requiring privatisation,
yeah.
it's pushed up administrative cost in the health sector enormously, because, you know, private patients have to be bureaucratised through the system, recorded through the system. And
I agree with all of that.
Yeah.
I think they think that if that the privatised system will be better. I know they're completely wrong. I can't imagine that they sit there thinking this is a price worth paying. Or maybe they do, because it's an incredible price. So on education, I don't agree with their policies. But I think they believe that free schools will somehow be better. I don't think they actually think these free schools will be really bad, and that's great because it means that our very expensive schools will look even better than our children too. But I don't, I mean, maybe you're probably one of the least unpartisan audiences in Oxford because the motives of Tories. Okay, go on.
Isn't there a problem which occurs with government, which is that the people who are making decisions are perhaps clever number crunchers? And when you're a number cruncher, with due respect to people who do this, I've got friends who are statisticians and whatever, you can detach yourself from what the rest of the core reality. And you can say it's X thousand this, you can play with medians and modes and whatever. And therefore, there isn't any sense, whereas those of us who are thinking about it think, oh my God, is that my mother? Or whoever. Whereas they're not thinking that, because their mother is living on the island estate or whatever.
Well, I think they partly are thinking of their mothers, because they want a system whereby their mothers and then them can carry on living on the land and the state. Mm. So whatever the answer, it always involves not touching their okay. position. But I don't think, so Phil, in the Chancellor in the budget, early on had a system who said, Britain is the most equal it's been by income for 30 years. Now, there is one statistic you can pick that shows that. It's the one that ignores the top 10% and the bottom
10%.
Yeah. No, it's ridiculous.
That's where all the interest is, isn't it?
Yeah. But I don't think he would have put it in there if he'd actually understood this. Yeah. And when Jeremy Hunt had his Twitter spat with that actor for the Royal Family a week ago, I think Jeremy was actually trying to win it. Whereas if Jeremy was really clever, he wouldn't have entered into the thing in the first place. Ian Duncan Smith has never understood universal credit. I mean, that was David Foy, he didn't even understand it himself, but he put his head down and let Ian Duncan Smith take the blame. Theresa May hasn't understood the immigration figures or student numbers. She didn't realise that students were actually all going home afterwards. I shouldn't be that. I'm left wing, I don't know why I'm arguing, but I think they are more stupid. The nasty. But it's either nasty or stupid in a combination of both.
Yes, a historical point on that, and I have a question too. The historical point is that in the 19th century, it depended much less on government decisions of expenditure, much more on local authority decisions of expenditure. And I think local authorities knew more about their areas and perhaps had more of a community interest in the infectious diseases were very respected at persons.
That's really interesting, that helps.
You've got your service at government.
So when I'm looking at that early thing, thinking this is incredible.
It's not really comparable sort of decision making.
Yeah, it wasn't Lord Salisbury National, was it? You're right, thank you.
Yeah, my question was about the surplus deaths of people aged 20 to 60 at the moment. Do we know what they're dying
of? Yes. Little bit of suicide, particularly around the 40s and 50s, those are the dangerous years, people don't realise. You're most likely to be killed by a car between 5 and about 25, 29 in Oxford. Then there's this 29 to about 40 suicide, then it's your heart. So for most of us, it's our hearts. A little bit, but not a little bit of suicide. Small increase in some drugs, particularly the older ones, particularly took drugs some time ago, not new. There's been links made to being sanctioned. People who are already very ill and disabled, having their benefits cut, that is now linked. But again, there you're looking at 700. We're talking 2,000 men, 1,000 women so far from that younger group. Women are generally more robust than men. Men are more fragile. This is one reason why there's this gap. Men don't talk to people. Either don't have as many friends. You know, and when you're doing very badly, and you've got mental health problems, you've got learning disabilities, and your benefits are cut entirely, and you're a man who's lost his parents and doesn't have any friends, you're much more likely to end up getting pneumonia than telling somebody it's gone wrong and they help you out.
Yes, I was at a seminar at the Side Business School about a fortnight ago on end-of-life care and how it develops, and they got annoyed when I got talking about that. And one of the things that cropped up, which I thought was quite interesting, was quite interesting because my father in law was affected by it, and that was policy issues such as the Liverpool pathway, which was introduced in the NHS and was actually used, for personal knowledge with my father-in-law, on things like nil by mouth, because it choked. Well, what they got was a questionnaire that said if people choked, they'd have been always choked over his food, but not for donkey years. But it didn't say. So I think there's also a policy issue, which is when it comes to the cash now using, how you actually implement a policy which can save, in a way, cash by, is it well, moving people on at a faster rate towards death or dealing with them in a different way and keeping them alive.
I agree with that.
And it seems to be very complex to me in terms of family relations, people relations, and then of course.
Yeah, and this has, these are the effects that's really hard to measure. So in Germany, they spend 46% more for personal healthcare than we do. That's $1 billion more a week. You need three of those red buses. In Switzerland, they spend twice as much per head. They're much more than in Europe. And when you're spending that, and they worry about their spending, okay, it's fair enough if you're spending the most in Europe, but I would much rather live in a country that spends twice as much. We are, despite the fact that the NHS is still very efficient, and efficient makes up for fit, we are now one of the lowest spenders. Some years we spend less per head than Greece on health. And this has to have an effect on these things. There are subtleties over what you, a weekend doctor was explaining to me, two kinds of do nots. And the one do not you want is the do not try and start my heart like that, physically violently, if I've got to a certain point in life. And that's the one you want on your notes, possibly. But you don't want the other one. But this will be happening in ways that are measurable because we've made these choices. But the other thing, I wish I could explain to people who are younger about what their old age will be like, because there'll be quite a lot of old people. But if we carry on the way we are, the carers will be so, you know, trodden down, that it'll be a terrible old age that people are going to be getting. Sorry,
Ross. Well, what you're basically saying is that they have good intentions, but they're doing things, they go about doing things the wrong way. But don't you think that 120,000 premature deaths would make them take a step back?
If they believe it, yes. I think, the Secretary of State for Health would see this paper, but the rest of the cabinet won't, because it's not been reported by the BBC, it's not been telegraphed with authorities.
Is it in their internal memos, is it actually a fact that they know?
Somebody mentioned it on Question Time. And as long as people keep on saying it and we get more reports, eventually this will get out. But they will have a mind of denial that you have to have, you can't. How do you? Well, this government are actually older than me, thankfully, but the last one, Cameron, were almost identical to my age. And I grew up here. They turned up here to go to Oxford University. I went north to Newcastle, but we swapped over. They fell in love with Margaret Thatcher as teenagers. If you'd done that, and you'd also stayed kind of in love with her your whole life, being told that your beliefs and policies did this, you're just going to refuse to accept it.
I suppose you can argue that life expectancy is not the be-all and end-all, and perhaps it's not as important as quality of life.
Yeah.
Do you have data or statistics that in some way relate quality of life to austerity or these other indicators that you've talked about?
That's a very good point. The official measure of healthy life expectancy But the component that goes into it is satisfaction with health. And I could show you a graph there where since 2010-11, every year, the satisfaction of the population with their own health has fallen fast. And the irony is, it's four of these measures of satisfaction with health, they've all got worse. They're all in David Cameron's happiness index that began in 2010 and nobody reported on. And it's got other measures in that index, dispersion measures, but the most important are health. So people are actually saying that the quality of life is getting worse. And for young people, it's mental health. And completely rational anxiety about the future. And then we tell them to kind of get a grip and pull themselves together. You know, what else do you think? How am I going to start a family and get a house? Sorry.
Yeah, what's your view on the potential for universal basic income to essentially deal with some of these issues, thinking about quality of life and reducing anxiety?
Yeah, especially for the young. Loads of experiments are going on, there's at least two dozen going on. Gordon Brown got somebody called Holly Sutherland to do a report for the whole of Europe over what would the effect be in a very low level of basic income, a few thousand euros.
Is that like Finland?
That's like, the Finland is more. I think that's like £700 a month, but in one particular part of Finland, they're doing better. The idea for the whole of Europe was you give people, say, 1,000 or 2,000 euros a year as a right. That goes a very long way in Romania. It doesn't go a very long way in Berlin. So the idea is that it reduces the incentives to migrate unless you're sure you want to do it. But also, you can't have 28 countries running 28 separate social security and pension systems. So the reason that Gordon Brown has to be modelled is that you can see that if you stay in the EU, at some point you're going to have a European-wide social security system. Then what can that be? And one answer is a very basic income. And you reduce it at a low level, slowly increase it, withdraw various other things. The one problem with it is that there'll always be people who need more than that. But it's not hardly an insolvable problem.
Does your data enable you to say whether social class differentials in life expectancy are widening as one would expect looking at the government's policies? And I know Michael Marmot has said that that is happening.
Yes, but only very recently, only in the last 2 years.
Right.
At the beginning we didn't get any of that, mainly because it was very elderly women.
Yeah.
And the areas with largely like Dorset, largely yeah. Very elderly women are pretty affluent areas. So it wasn't at the very start. But now it definitely is, and those areas which are seeing falls, a big falls from that perspective, are all the poorest parts.
I can't remember who it was. Somebody was talking on television about a month ago about the diseases of despair, which you sort of touched on, which are particularly prevalent among young males in the north,
yeah.
Which is suicide, drugs,
But the other one is
hard,
it's from
yeah.
You know, drinking or just not caring
yeah.
And being in a car or fighting alone and being hit. It's hard to get people to worry about their future in life.
Yeah.
I'm sure I've read a report that there's striking differences within the UK.
Yeah.
I think the stat I remember was there was a 10 to 15 year difference in survival between South Wales. The valleys of South Wales and London, and it was equated to 10 years, you know, a year every 10 miles you travel on the railway between those places.
Yeah.
Is that an extreme example of that difference within the UK? Or is it
no.
Actually, you know, you to travel to Newcastle and get a similar sort of differential?
No, we've got the biggest regional difference of any country in Europe. The country which had a big one before us was Germany.
Okay, but with East West Germany.
But they've solved it, that's actually now gone. And it's ironic, people say, oh, but the Germans understood each other and cared for each other. So you're thinking, what, we don't?
Yeah.
You know, we don't care about people in the North East. We don't see them the same as Germans in the West, so people, Germans in the East.
And you can see that you alluded to the Brexit plus argument earlier. I don't really want to open this up into that terms, but you know, you can see how a correlation with that spending in those geographical places would be correlated rather well with how the vote went.
almost all our towns have very steep inequalities. So Sheffield, where I lived up to 20 years, between Finnish and the North and parts of Cooksmore, London has a 20-year gap towards Oxford's, well, with the exception, Oxford's only got a 10-year gap. Funny, my dad always tried to claim credit because he's a GP, but that pleased me. It wasn't my dad overworking. It's actually quite hard to get into that at least. And it's hard, particularly hard now, and it's hard to say that if something goes wrong in your life, actually holding on in their time to the poorest part of Oxford. The lowest life expectancy is actually Southport, because it's the homeless hospitals. But also claret drinking in North Oxford. It's the inequality, but we're not a great example. The sad thing for Oxford, this is part of another lot of the South, is that if you split up from somebody, if you lose your job and you become ill, and you can't pay the private rent anymore, or the mortgage, you have to leave, and you actually end up steadily moving northwards.
I see my brain.
You mentioned that we can't do a control experiment with Jeremy Hunt and without, but what about Scotland and Wales? Are there any trends, I'm not sure of how much control they've got over their overall health budget in Scotland and Wales, but are there any different trends between England and Wales under the Tory government?
Well, Wales is very similar. Scotland is slightly worse, and we don't know why Scotland is slightly worse, or what, last time we looked 2 years ago. It could be colder.
But I mean, also the
Scottish government have a brilliant record on the investment in public services,
do you? No, but they got much better after the devolution. So after 1997, the Glasgow Reform Policy, which is awful, began to improve. They knocked down a whole load of tenements, which should have been knocked down years earlier, but it's much easier to do it locally. The Scottish situation is odd and needs to be looked at. What's happening is that quite well-meaning and nice Labour people in Scotland don't want to blame the SNP for this. They don't think it is the SNP's fault. They think it's the effects of national austerity. But as a result of that, you've got silence really at the moment. And there's a sort of deep kind of embarrassment about health in Scotland because Glasgow had the life, parts of Glasgow had the life of the split. Wasn't the worst in Europe. There's kind of a sensitivity about this in Scotland that I've got to stuck my foot in more than once.
I read really horrific articles in the newspaper about obesity. Now, you haven't mentioned much about obesity, but is that affecting statistics? I mean, that's very related to unemployment, to all that.
Yes.
And death rates. What research is going on
into
that?
There's a lot. We haven't had a sudden increase of obesity that fits with this, particularly of this demographic. So the large majority of people who are dying early are from before the obesity years. They're just too old to be part of that. Obesity began about amongst children in the early 90s, when you suddenly see it begin to take off. Before then, there wasn't much. The latest graphs I've seen are shocking. So we have the worst obesity rates in Europe, but only the Americans beat us. They're always worse. And the gap between children by social class is widening. You know, so I am a middle class academic. We try to semi-starve and fail to starve our children. This is what middle class people do with their children. To stop them becoming obese in an environment where it's so incredibly easy to become obese nowadays because of the food. And because the social pressure to do that when your middle class is so high. And so you're getting this division between the classes for young people. But that's not yet got through the years of death. The sad thing, in a way, good, because you can see the wind. These countries that are more equal, people are thinner. The Japanese the most, and then the Scandinavians. And it's easier to eat well and healthily. And you don't have that social class gap, which means that you're worrying about so much else that you don't worry about stopping your children eating far too much. So So, you know, if you want, there are so many reasons to want to have a nicer country for everybody. But as yet, it's not the cause. You also need a cause that's very sudden. Kills a few people in 2010, a lot more in 2011, even more in 2012. You know, it's the only thing that fits is austerity and the cuts and fits in areas. But if we carry on the way we are, the population will get more of these. People don't realise that poorer populations now get more of these. People are more anxious to get more of these. You're more susceptible to advertising. The food industry is less susceptible to be regulated. And people actually eat because they're frightened. I always think, do you remember Nick Griffin at the B&Q? He was great, he always munching away at crisps.
But poorer people are less skillful in the kitchen and maybe less about nutrition, and therefore something ready-made or out of freezer is easy. Not cheaper in the end, but...
Yeah, not cheaper, but easier.
Yeah.
But the temptation, the comfort of salty food and fatty food, and the comfort of McDonald's is, you know, and why plan ahead? You know, why worry about your own health when you're not sure whether a landlord's going to give you 2 months' notice, or you're going to keep your job, or, you know, that's part.
Just another difference with 150 years ago. They used to have public inquiries into things like the health of town, physical deterioration, and their ill disease, animals, housing, you know, all these things were available publicly, with a view to coming up with some sort of consensual public interest type model was needed. This seems to have gone out completely.
No, we have small inquiries now, is the company, they're very rare. And this government isn't going to pick on this. Ironically,
it all seems politicized when something comes up with what might be a sensible solution.
The European Union could do it, because across Europe it's a problem. We're by far the worst. But after us, there are other countries where things haven't been good. Still improving, but not as much. And then, countries like I mentioned, Finland and Norway, but also Denmark and the Netherlands, which are doing pretty well. So there's actually a European range of reactions to the banking crisis and health, and it's all since 2008, 2009 and 2010. So a European-wide study done by people on the mainland of Europe who don't care much about the UK would actually be quite good, because we would just be one of 28 observation points.
Assessment how Australia measures up compared to us, and my answer, they haven't really had austerity, but they kind of, because they were trading in commodities and stuff, they rode out the 2008 crisis.
Yeah, so their health has continued to improve. So is New Zealand's. They essentially sell the stuff to China, and China turns into stuff for us.
And the Uranium.
So they didn't pay. The other advantage they've got is immigration, because migrants tend to be healthy. So our only age group, 2015 was a pretty bad year for deaths. The only age group which didn't see a rise in mortality was 25-29-year-olds. And 25-29s had 60,000 net immigrants. And this is young, healthy, qualified people from Europe. So, I mean, one great irony is that we're at the bottom of this European league table of life expectancy, apart from Denmark. But we're only there because we've got a large number of incredibly healthy young Europeans in this country. And if they go, and if we replace some of them with elderly people from Spain, the ones who can't afford the Spanish healthcare in the future, can you imagine bringing them? I mean, amazing, I wouldn't go on about that. There is no other country in Europe. We did just have a special deal where we didn't actually pay how much we should pay in. We have the best demographic deal of all. We got the youngest and fittest and healthiest and most qualified coming here. And we actually exported. David Cameron's that, Nick Clegg's that, and they all die. The French health service had to look after them in the end. It's quite an unbelievable thing we're about to do to ourselves. Is there one last question? Because I think I've gone on for a long time. They've got a burning last one?
It's not really a question, it's that choice between are the elite of this country callous or are they stupid? Well, most of them are highly educated, go to Oxford, and have private schools before that. So I would suggest it's not because they're stupid.
Then they do know.
I think it must be deliberate. Yes. And that's a horrifying.
It's putting ideology above evidence.
Yeah, it is. This weighs on my mind. The longer this thing goes on, that's your sort of thinking. How do you look at yourself in the mirror? How do you carry on while the evidence isn't clear? Although, as I work in university, you may do, but they're not as brilliant.
Are you thinking of taking this to the papers?
You did a BBC program.
Did the BBC program? Yeah, what we're trying to do, we've probably got a paper with the BMJ and some of the consideration. So the way we do it is you try to get the referee paper in first.
Okay.
And that gives you, it makes sure you're not making an awful mistake. But B, it actually gives a reason for papers to cover it. So got one in currently under consideration and another smaller thing that may come out this week. But there are lots of other people. There's about 30 people across the country, academics, now working on this.
In terms of how to get attention to this in the political sphere, do you brief this stuff to John Natural from the Labour Help Team so they can answer questions in the House about it?
No, perhaps I should do. Abraham, what's the name?
Devin.
Because
I just think it's the kind of thing they could really get their teeth into, absolutely. Or the Health Select Committee could run an inquiry on increasing mortality or something.
Even Sarah Champion, although she's a Tory, she's the right person.
She's a VP.
Yeah, but she's a Tory, but she...
If she did, she's got a
VP.
Yeah.
But I mean, Channel 4 News, not only you, watch it. But journalists are incredibly lazy, and they follow each other. And if Channel 4 News check it, talk for it, it will get right.
Because the last point, I learned on a physical point, I think this is interesting. So, I can remember before the election in June, people worrying that I didn't not hear about speech. People worried about speech, right? And obviously, in hindsight, you didn't need to worry about speech, but it's where you did, but there was actually no need. So now we look out north, you know, and you're looking across the Swindon, and you're looking down to Bedding and places, and wondering what might happen. Remember, the one thing people in the county care about is the John Radcliffe and their health in old age. And the one thing going worse, even worse than the economy, worse than good jobs, worse than the housing market, the thing that has been mucked up the most is your chance of enjoying your old age. For these people, in those areas, the people in Oxford East Labour Party are now thinking perhaps we ought to go out on the weekends. It just looks to me, you know, it's not just about wanting the John Radcliffe to be able to staff himself and still work when you need it. It's the Meals and Wheels services going, the rural bus services going, the other things that tip people over on the edge. I think you've got a national issue which matters most to an age group who are not now young idealistic people who will happily vote for a party that says no tuition fees. Right? The age group who are most against Labour are the age group most affected by this. It's kind of like a win-win, isn't it? Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.